considering converting a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. Who has or is interested in a flexible spending account? Is it a good idea to close out some credit card accounts, especially if you want to make some big purchases? Those are some of the questions financial planner Kevin McKinley pulled out of the On Your Money email bag for today, and we have plenty of room for your questions, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and this is a special all-questions-answered edition of On Your Money. This is the last time Kevin will be with us this year. He's off the show for the holidays, and we didn't want 2013 to end without opening the lines for the full hour for your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Do you have a question about a money issue, perhaps something you can do before the end of the year? Or do you want to resolve to do a better job managing your money in the year to come? Maybe you need some advice. This is the show for you. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio Studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
And ho, ho, ho to you. Are you having a happy holiday season?
I definitely am. And you?
Yes, I am. And this is a very special year-end edition of On Your Money. And I know, Kevin, that you want to say thank you to our dear listeners.
Yes, that's correct. For all the people who are patient enough to put up with this show for an entire hour, and some people do it for multiple hours in a given week. And to all of those pledgers who, during our most recent membership drive, contributed money to the show and Wisconsin Public Radio, we are going to spend the entire hour answering questions. Some have been emailed in previously. You can email it in now at onyourmoney@wpr.org, or you can call during the show and we'll try to get it in.
And let me just say before we start answering questions that Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice for this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And to kick off the answers that we'll be providing today, we've received several questions in the past few weeks regarding converting IRAs, traditional IRAs, to Roth IRAs and the taxation of Social Security benefits in retirement. So how are these issues connected, Kevin?
Well, they are, and very much so. It's all about income and retirement and at what rate it is going to be taxed. And this is something that can be worked on for people who have not yet retired, but it's an especially good idea to pay attention to it for people who are retired already, because we not only know what the tax rates are right now, what type of income will be taxed, but also we can control it as well. And so there are several steps and plans that we can take today to minimize that taxation while making sure we still get the income that we're expecting.
Okay, so where do we begin?
There's a very crucial phase, and it's while income is low. Hopefully, if your income is reduced before you retire, maybe you're working in a part-time job still, or you've retired completely, but before you start taking Social Security, that's the best time to convert IRAs to Roth IRAs each year, and hopefully to the top of the 15% federal income tax bracket. And again, that's delineated on line 43 of the 1040. And for married couples filing jointly, it's $72,500, again on line 43. And about half that for individual filers. And hopefully you can do that without actually needing the money from your IRA to live off of, in that you can live off, maybe you have a pension or maybe you have a savings you can withdraw, or you have some other part-time job, as we mentioned, that can help supplement that so you can convert all of the money from the IRA rather than having to live off of some of it each year.
All right. So then what do you do? Then what, Kevin? Well, I'm not sure why Kevin can't hear me all of a sudden. Can you hear me, Kevin? Well, I'm going to...
Hello?
Hello, Kevin. What do we do then?
Oh, Well, once you've converted as much as you can afford per year, hopefully you can do the whole IRA. But then once you've exhausted any savings or you need the money to actually live off of, you can't roll it over into the Roth IRA, then that's the time to initiate Social Security. And after that point, then just withdraw money from the IRA only to the point where Social Security will be taxable. And we'll talk about that after the first of the year on what kind of figures you can use in estimating that. Then use Roth IRAs or your savings, and some people should even consider using a home equity line of credit, especially near the end of the year here, because it's better off to pay a little bit of interest for a few weeks until after the first of the year, until you can finally pull out the money off of the other accounts and then pay off the home equity line of credit.
The magic of radio, Kevin. We have fixed our little technical glitch, and I think we shall be smooth sailing from here on in. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jen in Madison, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I'll be coming into some inheritance money, hopefully, in 2014. And just wanted to run by the ideas of where we're going to be splitting up the money in different places and wanted to see what your thoughts are. The first thing we were thinking about is storing some into retirement and taking care of some of our high-interest loans and then beefing up our savings to the six-month mark. And just wanted to see if what your thoughts are and if there's anything else in addition you would recommend.
I think you've actually covered several of the points right now. You said you've got some high interest loans and some retirement savings that you're working on?
Yeah, I've got a school loan that's pretty high.
Okay, what is pretty high in your definition?
I believe it's 7%.
Okay, that's fairly high. I'd like to see you pay that one down. And then you mentioned something about adding to retirement accounts?
Yes, we both have 401ks.
Okay, good. Are you maxing out the 401ks right now?
My husband is. I am not.
Okay, and since both of you, are both of you working full-time?
My husband is, and I am working part-time.
Okay, good. I'd like to see you maximize the 401ks first, because that will probably give you an instant rate of return of about 20 to 30% in the form of lower income taxes come April 15th of the following year. And so it's much better to pay to put that money into the 401k to the greatest extent you can. And then the second thing is to pay off that high interest loan. And then do you have any other credit card debts or anything like that?
No, we pay those off monthly.
Okay, good. No, I think it's a great a great way that you've laid this out. Keep some savings set aside, though, so that you can always maximize the retirement plans. And especially in your situation, especially when investments seem to have appreciated a lot in the last few years, prices are fairly high, you can invest it conservatively. A lot of people don't defer as much as they can and should into retirement plans, not because they can't afford it, but they're worried about putting it into something that's going to go down in value. Well, try to find a conservative option in the retirement plan, if that is a concern of yours, and then put it in there just so you can get the pre-tax break on the savings. It's one of the best ways to increase your net worth is by paying less in taxes.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, so I really appreciate you addressing that.
All right. Thanks very much, Jen, for the call. Next, we'll go to Nancy in Appleton. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. I'd like to ask your guest how I should pay off some student loans for my daughter. She's got about $30,000 in student loans, and I've been putting money ever since she was little into some stocks. Hmm. And right now, I can pay those loans off right away if I convert those stocks to cash. But I'm wondering if I should do that, what the tax penalties will be if I do it all in one lump sum, or if I should do it over several years, converting a little bit at a time.
Sure. Are they actual stocks, or are they mutual funds that purchase stocks?
They're actual stocks.
All right. And do you happen to know what the capital gains bill would be, like how much you've
made on
those?
No, I have no idea.
Okay.
None whatsoever.
Okay, that's a common issue. Are they things that you've bought for the last 10 years or the last 30 years, or what kind of time frame are we talking about, Nancy?
We're talking the last 30 years.
30 years. Okay, that's all right. And there's really no way that you can figure out the cost basis of, going back. Have you done like a dividend reinvestment plan where you've had multiple purchases?
Okay. Yes, I've done dividend reinvestment. The stock has split at least three times.
And do you hold the shares or are they held in a brokerage account?
I hold them.
You hold them. So they keep sending you these pieces of paper, and it's a great problem to have. But when you come to sell, it creates an issue of figuring out the actual cost basis, and that's one of your concerns, right?
Right. And it's one of the top – it's one of the Fortune 500 companies, and I'm wondering if there's some kind of online calculator that could help me out with that.
There is, and there's a technically, here's what you have to do according to the letter of the law. There are two ways to do this. One way is you actually have to figure out what the real cost basis is and go back and figure not only what the purchase price was way back when, and there is historical data you can use to figure that out, but then you even have to know the actual date, and then you actually have to add in all of those quarterly dividend repurchases and count them as individual purchases as well to create the cost basis. So we're talking four dividend payouts probably per year. So you're looking at 120 different purchases over 30 years of time. That's the first way to do it. The second way, the IRS says, according to the letter of the law, if you can't do that and you can't come up with a number, then you have to assume that the cost basis is zero and the entire proceeds will be taxed as capital gains. Now, that may be frightening and daunting, but the good news is for people in the lower income tax brackets, 15%.
We're very, very – we're in really low income tax brackets.
Okay. That's actually – that's good news for this situation, Nancy, because what it means is that the long-term capital gains on those sales, the rate will probably be zero. Even if you are in the 15% federal income tax bracket, and again, if you're married filing jointly, we're looking at $72,500 on line 43 of your 1040 for 2013. So here's what I would suggest. I would suggest you sell $10,000 worth of the stock now in 2013. Sell another $10,000 on January 2nd, let's say. And so that'll give you $20,000 that you can give. And because it's divided into two separate income tax years, and because you've said your income tax rate is likely to be very low, you can still report zero as the cost basis. And all of that profit will go on as capital gains, but you'll probably won't pay any federal taxes on it at all. And then finally, maybe if you can wait another year and do it again in 2015, that can be the final $10,000. The other nice thing about that is you and you can give your daughter $14,000 per year with no gift tax filing. And even if you want to give her more than that in a particular year, you can do it. You just have to file a gift tax return, but you won't owe any gift tax on it. But if you want to just give her the proceeds each year, you can give her the $10,000 this year, $10,000 next year, and then $10,000 in 2015. And the great way about doing it right now is that's only a little over a year. It's about a year and 2 weeks, but the tax liability will be spread out over three tax calendar years, 13, 14, and 15.
Thanks, Nancy, and good luck. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, and this is a special All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money. Kevin is here for one last time in 2013 to answer your personal finance questions, and we will have coming up some advice from questions from listeners and emails about flexible spending accounts and making big purchases despite open accounts and more. And plenty of room for your question at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is a special All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is David in Madison. Hello, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got another question about converting a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. So I'm currently in my late 50s. My wife is in her early 40s. She's the main money maker in the household, and I know that when I hit 70 and a half, in a traditional IRA, I have to start taking money out. We don't need the money, and I'm wondering if it makes sense at this point in my life to start converting that to a Roth IRA so that when I hit 70 and a half, I have a choice about whether or not I have to take it out.
It's an excellent point, David, and it's one of the many features of having money in a Roth IRA versus a regular IRA. As of today, Roth IRAs have no mandatory distribution date, at least while the owner is still alive. The other nice thing about it is distributions from Roth IRAs, again, today, are not included in the formula that determines whether or not Social Security is taxable. So you can take $1 million out of a Roth IRA, and it won't be any more likely to make your Social Security taxable in retirement. But my concern would be that if your wife is still making a decent amount of money, that doing it now versus waiting until later might put you in a higher income tax bracket today that you don't necessarily want or need to be in. And so my preference is if you're going to make that conversion, you do it in years in which you're going to be at a very low or no income tax rate. And that might mean because there's a temporary loss of earnings, it could be some stock losses or business losses or some charitable contributions or whatever that drive that taxable income down. So if I were you, I would wait until she actually retires and stops earning income before I would make that conversion.
So what you're saying is then I'll have to start taking that money at 70 and a half, because if she retires at 65, I'm going to be in my late 70s at that point, so I'll have had to start taking minimum distributions for at least 8 years at that point.
That's correct, but the minimum distributions are relatively minimal, and usually only about 3% to 4% or so of the value in the first year, depending on how you choose to do it. And so even if you have $100,000 in that account when you turn 70 and a half, David, you might have to take $3,000 to $4,000 out in that first year.
Can I ask another quick question? And this is more if you can give me an idea of a place to look. I am a U.S. citizen, but I've only been a U.S. citizen for the last 4 or 5 years, and I was born in Canada, and I have a modest retirement plan it's the equivalent of an IRA back in Canada, and I have no idea of how I convert that over into the U.S. Do I wait till I retire to do that? And I don't know where to start looking or who to talk to.
Do you receive a statement from that plan, David?
I receive a statement from them. It's basically the same thing as a traditional IRA. It's money that's invested in through a company into mutual funds.
Okay. My guess is on that statement, there's a phone number that you can call to see how to get that money out of there if indeed you want to and should do it. I've seen this a few times before, and usually what it comes down to is unless you need the money to spend it, it's probably best to leave it in there because there's going to be tax implications of transferring it out of that account and into your own pocketbook. And so I'd much rather have you leave it in there if that's the case, again, at least until you retire.
Thanks, David, for the call, and good luck to you. There's something about David's accent that tipped me off that he is from Canada or the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
I choose not to denigrate our fine neighbors to the north.
I'm not denigrating. I have my accent too.
No, Julie. You don't. You have the perfect broadcasting Midwestern. It's
that
so finely
Midwest
honed. It's
nasal
one of the things
thing.
We grow very well here in the Midwest is on the air broadcasters.
Julia in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the show. My husband is 58, I'm 55, and he has an IRA set up. I have nothing set up. He's recently disabled and has filed for Social Security disability. I am also unable to work. Neither one of us are receiving that right now. He's only worked 1 month in 2013, but we had to pay our mortgage off this year, which we had to withdraw some monies out of his IRA. So we're looking to offset the tax bill because we're not able to put that back in there that we paid off our first home mortgage. So we're just wondering how much we can put in the IRAs, or can we create one for myself and maybe Roth or money to grandkids. We've already donated, you know, things to charity and stuff. We don't have a flexible spending account or anything like that set up. So we're just wondering if there's anything else, you know, what can we do now, you know, to help offset that tax bill.
This is the tax bill that's coming in by April 15th of 2014
yes.
for the 2013 tax year, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
correct.
Julia. About the only thing you can do is make, you can itemize and do all those other things you normally would try to do with your income tax savings. Other than that, the biggest way to do it is use any earned income that you did have in 2013 as the basis for a contribution to an IRA. And the good news is you have until April 15th of next year to make that contribution, assuming you can do it. Other than that, there's not a lot of other things that can be done in this situation to mitigate that or to offset the tax bill that's going to come. How much was the distribution you had to take to pay off the house?
Roughly about $244,000.
Okay, so it's a pretty significant dollar amount. But the good and the bad news is you were going to pay taxes on that anyway, and you were going to pay it sooner or later. But, of course, what we hope, and especially in your case, your husband was very close to getting past 59 and a half, so he could have avoided any penalties if he could have waited another year and a half to do that. He still would have had to pay taxes on it, but you are going to have to pay penalties on it. If you don't have any other investments that have losses in them, the charitable deductions, you sound like you covered it. Again, the charitable deductions is a nice way to get a tax break, but you still have to give the money away. And so you only get a portion of the amount you give back in the form of the tax break on it. I would definitely go to, Julie, if you Google a website called TaxCaster, that's TurboTax puts that up, and you can go through it. You don't have to register. You don't have to pay for it, but you can put your information in for 2013, and that will not only give you an idea of what your tax liability might be, but it will give you a few hints based on your individual situation and details of some steps that you might be able to take to reduce that tax bill still this year.
Good luck, Julia. Thank you for the call. This is a special All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money, spending the entire hour with your questions, your calls at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our caller just brought up the flexible spending account, Kevin, wondering if she should open one up. But let's talk a little bit about that, since we've received a number of emails from concerned listeners regarding the flexible spending account. Why are people worried about their flexible spending accounts?
The flexible spending account, just for people who don't know or need to be reminded, it's where workers make pre-tax contributions to it. They can make up to $2,500 in contributions to it. And then they can pull the money out tax-free and use it for qualified medical expenses. And this might be uncovered medication costs, might be chiropractic treatments, could be co-payments that people incur, could be dental or vision expenses. There's a huge number and types of expenses that can qualify to be used for tax-free distributions from the FSA.
So why the stress right now?
Well, it's because we're coming up on the end of the year, and usually money that is not used in an FSA, it is a use-it-or-lose-it proposition. And so if the money isn't spent, it's forfeited. And sometimes some companies have provisions in the plan where they can the employee or the FSA account owner can have up until the middle of March. It's a 2.5-month kind of a grace period to use the money again. And other companies don't have that, and other people say, well, I don't know. I mean, I still have to spend that money to get the offset for it, and I don't know what I can spend it on. But there are some new rules that have just come out for the 2013 year that might be able to help those people.
What are those new rules?
Some money could be carried over into the next year. The IRS says, according to the new rules, that up to $500 can be rolled over from an unused FSA account balance into the next year and going forward. So you have a long time to use that, your entire work history, really. It does have to be for the 2013 calendar year, and the employer has to allow it as part of the provision. You can't just say, well, this is a new rule, I'm going to take advantage of it. Your employer who sponsors the flexible spending account must allow it as a provision of the plan. So you definitely want to check with your employer first before you say, well, I'm just going to wait until next year to do it, or I'm not going to spend it at all right now.
So what advice do you have for listeners who are interested in flexible spending accounts?
Think of it as an inconvenient discount. Again, the higher your income, the bigger the tax break is, and so the better it is. And it can be a 30 to 40% discount in the form of lower taxes, but you do have to have not only medical expenses, but you have to track the receipts and document it and make sure that the specific medications or medical products purchased fit under it. So you definitely tax it, but also check with your employer, and you have to check with the employer every year because these things can change every year, both from an IRS status, but also from the employer terms in the HR department. So you might want to go to IRS publication 502, and that's the one that tells what every single type of expense is covered for FSA expenditures.
This is On Your Money. This is a special all questions answered edition of On Your Money. It's a way for financial planner Kevin McKinley and for me to say thank you for all of your support during this year, during 2013. So if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Bonnie in Manitowoc. Hello, Bonnie. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Joy and Kevin. Thank you so much for taking my call today. My husband is retired. I'm due to retire in a few years. And my employer just last year for 2013 started an HSA. And because of my advanced age, I have taken advantage of putting as many dollars as we can into that account. My question is, now as we're looking at medical expenses for 2013-2014, is it best to use that HSA money or should we put that on hold and save it for our retirement use and use out-of-pocket cash right now?
Are these big expenditures, Bonnie, or are they smaller ones?
Typically it's about $3,000 a year.
Okay. And the reason I ask that is because under some provisions, if one has very large medical expenditures, it's better off to deduct those expenses to the extent they exceed either 10% or 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, depending on your age. Are you going to be in a lower tax bracket likely in retirement, Bonnie, than you are right now?
Yes.
Okay. Then I would tell you to pull it out of the HSA because then it comes out tax-free. And the lower your tax bracket is, the lesser the benefit of that tax-free status of the HSA contribution. So, and just for people who know, HSA is different from the FSA to which we were previously discussing. And HSA is a health savings account, and that's something that is a tax deferral to pull out and use to pay the deductible usually. And if you don't use it, you don't lose it. An HSA rolls over automatically every single year till you turn 65, and then it kind of becomes an IRA in that you have to, you can pull the money out, but it's only taxed as ordinary income, much like an IRA would be. So offhand, Bonnie, based on your description, I tell you to use it sooner rather than later.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie, for the call. And I'm glad you answered that, Kevin. I was about to say, what's the diff between an FSA and an HSA? There's lots of... all right, let's go to an email from Mike. And he says, why can you no longer get paper copies of stock certificates? I like my paper.
That, thanks to the digital world, most... I would say the vast majority of the trillions of dollars that are held somewhere in the world are in the forms of ones and zeros on a computer hard drive someplace. And it's discouraging to people who are comfortable with not only the tangible piece of paper, but also people who just say, I like it. I like to know where it is, and I don't want to know that, you know, someone could get access to this if they can't get access to my safe or my safe deposit box. But for ease of transaction, for the registration issues, and for tracking it, it's highly unlikely that paper certificates, bonds, any kinds of securities will ever be issued again. And it's one thing I would recommend. If you do have a lot of paper certificates, or sometimes people have a parent who's been accumulating these paper savings bonds or stock certificates. Try to get them someplace where it can be at least held and registered. And that might be in a many times if they're shares of stock, there's a registrar that will hold those shares and hold them in a digital account for tax purposes. It's easier to track it that way. But it's also easier to adjust for splits. And as we mentioned, Nancy's previous call about trying to figure out where those shares are, what they were, what the cost basis is. It's a little easier if they are held digitally rather than in paper. But if you like the paper, keep it. Just understand that blacksmiths aren't seen around very much, and neither are going to be paper stock certificates.
Art in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Art.
Hi. So, Kevin, my wife and I are both retirement age or plus, and we have almost all of our investments in mutual funds and stocks, very little in bonds. So I was thinking of selling some of that so that we could purchase before the end of the year, I think, $10,000 for each of us in I-bonds, and then after the beginning of next year, another $20,000 between us in I-bonds. So does that fit with the rules, and does it make sense?
Yeah, I think it does make sense, Art, and I do like I-bonds, not as some way to get rich quick or even slowly, but it's a great place to store some cash, get a little bit of interest on it. It is a big hassle to purchase them. You go to treasurydirect.gov, and you have to create an account, and then you can purchase $10,000 each per person per year. And so, again, in the next 3 weeks or so, you could purchase a total of $40,000 of I-bonds. And the neat thing about them is, first of all, they do pay a little bit of interest. I think it's 1.18%. The interest is exempt from state taxes, so that's a little better than the money market or CD you might get at a similar rate at a local bank or credit union. And then finally, you can defer the taxation on that interest by not cashing the bonds in. Bondholders get to choose when they report the interest earned on those, either annually or at the time of withdrawal. And the interest rate is tied to the consumer price index. It goes up and down every May 1st and November 1st. It's changed if the consumer price index changes quite a bit. And generally, you can get the money out fairly easily after 12 months with just a three-month penalty. And after holding it for 5 years, there's no penalty to pull it out whatsoever. So I definitely recommend it as a safer place to keep cash. I'd also like to see you look at longer-term CDs, especially if you can find ones that have manageable penalty for early withdrawal, like 6 months to a year's worth of interest.
Good luck, Art. Thanks for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is a special All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money. We have an open line for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin. Maybe some advice to better manage your money in the year to come. Maybe some end-of-the-year money move that you are considering. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin has gone through the mailbag and has picked a few listener emails, and we'll have a couple more of those in just a few minutes. This is the Ideas Network.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you'd like to run a question by Kevin. And a listener in Milwaukee sent an email. He says he's a recent college grad and has almost a dozen open credit card accounts, plus he has some outstanding student loan balances. He wants to make some big purchases, like a car and a home, in the very near future. While his credit score, he says, is good now, he thinks lenders may not like all of his open accounts. And Kevin, he wonders what he should do.
Well, I hope by outstanding he means it's a larger amount rather than it's really cool.
it's excellent.
These are outstanding. You say that to the lender, too. Yes. Do you have any student loan balances? Yes, I do. I have some outstanding student loan balances.
All right. So let's say they are large.
Okay. Let's clarify a few things, too. The score does matter. Credit score definitely matters, not only when the listener is borrowing money, but also on insurance rates like auto insurance, trying to rent, cell phone contracts, and also even job applications can take credit reports into consideration when making a decision to hire an applicant. In terms of the percentage of the score, about 30% of the credit score is based on the dollar amounts owed in the credit card accounts. The lender will be concerned with the credit score, but may be more concerned with the number of accounts open, just because those accounts can be tapped at any given time if the accounts are open, and those balances can be ratcheted up and become even more outstanding at any given moment, which may create a problem not only for the borrower, but also for the lender getting paid back if the borrower has too much debt outstanding. So it's better to manage them appropriately and then try to minimize the accounts now rather than doing it later. Many lenders will come to people and say, hey, no offense, I can give you the loan. We need to do something about closing these accounts. And that can take a long time to do, so it's better to approach it when you don't need to do it rather than when you do need to do it.
Yeah. Well, so how do you close an account, though, if you still owe money on an account?
It's best to keep about a third of the, no more than a third of the available credit in a balance. So if it's possible, he should consolidate those accounts. If not, pay down the bigger balances first until he can get to that third ratio. So if he has, let's say, a total of $10,000 of available credit, he should have no more of $3,000 or $4,000 in outstanding credit charged up onto those cards, and then try to consolidate them, meaning he can move the accounts from one to the other and try to put the balances all into one account, and try to do it on the oldest credit card. There is some value to having older and more mature credit card relationships rather than a new credit card that you just opened up. So if he can, he should try to move it to the older ones first, and then consider ones that offer lower fees or lower interest rates.
So what else does he have to do?
He should contact all these companies first to find out what they can do for him, because many of them are interested in consolidating the balance for him to their specific account. They might give him better terms than what he's already getting. However, he should try to get it in writing when he contacts the company and say, could you just send me some kind of letter with the offer telling me what you're giving me? And to move this over, they might get him a 0% balance on money transferred within the first year. And then also, he needs to be very careful as to how he closes the account, because sometimes, lost in the shuffle, the closing actually shows up on a credit report as looking like the credit card company closed the account, which that can negatively affect his credit rating as well. So remember, you're breaking up with someone. You have to get it on record that you broke up with them, not that they dumped you in the first place. Creditcards.com, which is a really neat website anyway, has a template that people can use to ask the right questions, to get the right answers from the credit card companies, and then to check off the process to make sure it's done okay. And we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, that's great. But just to clarify, how do you make sure the credit card company knows, or the credit bureau knows, that you're dumping your credit credit card, not the other way around?
Good question. Make sure it's noted on the credit report that it was closed at customer's request. Verify it with the company a couple times during the process. And then also, once it's done, go to annualcreditreport.com. You get one free report per bureau per year. So you want to download all three of the biggest bureaus' reports at annualcreditreport.com and check to make sure that it shows up on those to say that you broke up with them, they did not dump you.
I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is a special All Questions Answered edition of On Your Money. 1-800-642-1234 is our number if you have a question you'd like to run by Kevin. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Next we go to Mark in Madison. Hello, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. So I'm in my 30s, and my company, like many, are offering a new Roth 401k. And I understand, you know, the tax implications now versus later based on income. But I can't reconcile the money not going in to the Roth at an earlier age and, you know, growing and compounding interest. So can you help me understand that?
Yes, you can. You're saying that you don't see the advantages of making a contribution to a retirement plan that's not tax deductible now and then getting the money to be able to pull it out tax-free later on, right?
Well, you know, on the assumption that, let's say, my tax bracket is the same now and later, which is, you know, it's a hypothetical any which way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, it seems sensible to put that significant portion of money into the traditional 401k at an earlier age versus then taking it out now, not knowing what taxes will do in the future, of course.
That's correct. Most people, Mark, even in, many people dread the future and say that it's going to be higher taxes in the future, and so I should pay the taxes now and make a after-tax contribution to the Roth 401k first. And that's just not true for most people, in part because even if you said, oh, well, the country's running all these deficits and they're going to figure out a way to raise our taxes, it's very difficult to raise a lot of taxes, especially income taxes, on people of modest income, because you have to tax all of their income. And if they don't have any income, they can't spend it and they can't survive. So for most people, they spend less money in retirement than they do while they're working. And in part, that's because they can control their income from a tax standpoint. And so usually most people are in a lower tax bracket than they are in retirement. Therefore, it's much better to make contributions to the 401k now, get all of the money working for you, if you will, although there's some question as to the value of that over the near term. But just to get the biggest tax break possible now and then pull it out in retirement at a lower tax bracket. Now, one way you can do this is if you do have a year in which you are going to have a low tax rate, again, due to lower income, losses in a business, capital losses, big donations, whatever, that's the year to use the Roth 401k. Otherwise, it's usually better to use the regular traditional 401k, get the pre-tax contribution in, again, until you get to the 15% federal income tax bracket, and then switch to Roth IRAs. And the cool thing about Roth IRAs, of course, is that you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And so that makes kind of a neat ersatz savings account for you. And then it still gives you some tax deferral on the money because it's sheltered. And then when you pull it out in retirement, there are no taxes whatsoever on the Roth IRA. So that's a better way to balance it out than using the Roth 401k at work.
Good luck, Mark. Now on to Mary in Pewaukee, who has an excellent question because I have the same question. Hi, Mary.
Hi again, Joy. Yes, I'm getting my money's worth today. It's my second time I get to be on. Thank you very much. Kevin, okay, our savings equal about the same as our mortgage, our property taxes just came in. So we could pay it off, but we'd have no savings. What percentage is it going to help us in paying less taxes in April or by April 15th by paying off all versus half and then the other half in July?
So you've got this money. You're going to pay it off. Are you saying paying your mortgage or your property taxes?
Property tax.
Property taxes. Okay.
Yes.
Do you itemize every single year?
Yes.
Okay. It's a wash then. And especially if your income is going to be the same year to year, then I would rather have you just pay it off, pay the property taxes when they're due, not trying to accelerate it to get the deduction for it, in part because I wouldn't want you to use up that savings. And if you do have to use it for a more pressing emergency, then you're going to have the you're going to have that money there for you, and then you get several weeks or months to figure out where the property taxes are going to come from. Whereas if you pay it off now, it's done, and then if that emergency comes up, so is the money gone as well.
Mary, thanks for the call. We have always paid off the property tax bill in full before the end of the calendar year, so we would itemize that deduction in the taxes. But I think I was advised by someone who knows more than I do, not you, Kevin, I should have asked you, with the mortgage almost paid off now and an impending retirement, that we should consider actually just paying half of the property tax in a year and carry over the other half, so we'd have we'd actually be paying more taxes in one calendar year. Does that make sense?
Right. It's called bunching the deductions. And what some people can do, if they can get together, if they have a bigger property tax bill and they're kind of on the borderline between getting enough deductions to itemize or just using the standard deduction, it's better then to accelerate any property tax payments into the year in which you would itemize. And then in the following year, you just take the standard deduction and pay as little in property taxes as you possibly can, because that usually is the biggest form of deduction for people who are older and don't have any mortgage interest out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it's a good idea to bunch those deductions in one year, take the bigger deduction. But that standard deduction is getting close to $12,000 now for married couples filing jointly, so it's getting pretty big. And so it's some, for some people, it's a good problem to have, but it's hard to find enough deductions, even with property taxes, to itemize.
All right, let's go to Tim in La Crosse next. Hello, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have about $100,000 in a target dated fund. It's a 2030 fund that mature, expecting that I'll be start pulling it out in the year 2030. And the expense ratio on it is 0.13. Now, when I get my statements, it never, I can never see, or it never shows how much I'm paying for this this fund. And I'm just curious if that, what your guest thinks of a 0.13 expense ratio, if that, if that's a fair competitive value.
Does that happen to be a Vanguard sponsored target date fund?
No, it is a black it's a Blackwater.
Okay. Maybe BlackRock.
No, it's through, well, yeah, BlackRock. That's
okay.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. If it really is just 0.13%, and we're talking now 0.013%. If it's 1.3%, that's terrible, and that means that for every
0.013%.
Okay, that's very good then. That's a very fair expense. That's not the only expense you're paying. Many, there are other expenses that are tied up in there, and the trading expenses, and they can hide them in that big, thick prospectus that they put online or direct you to read every year, Tim, that you never do and nobody does. That's where those other expenses are paid there. But in terms of measurable reported expense ratios, that's actually a very competitive rate if it is indeed 0.013%.
Thanks very much, Tim, for the call. One other email we received from a listener, a customer service worker named Nicholas, echoed our sentiments about getting good customer service from call center representatives. He said to let the service agents speak and go through their script and don't keep repeating yourself or be long-winded. He says this will keep the call shorter, so both of you will be happier. Anything to add to that, Kevin?
Well, both of the regular listeners to this show know how difficult it is for me to not repeat myself or be long-winded. So this is very good advice. I appreciate you sending that along, Nicholas. And I will say this, too, and I'm guilty of this myself. When you are on the phone with these people, it is whatever problem you have with this product or service, if you've been directed to a call service, I can guarantee few things in life other than that the person on the other end of the line in the call center did not create your problem. And so try to understand that they are a person with feelings, and they react to things. They try to be as disciplined as they possibly can and not take it. But the nicer you are to them, if you can take a deep breath, slow down, say, hey, Nicholas, how's your day? Good. Here's my situation. I want to know if you can help me out. The more calm, the more rational, and the easier it is for you to work with them and stay in a calm place. The more likely it is that that person on the other end of the line is going to help you.
Yeah, it's not their fault. Time for the website of the week.
Yeah, we're going to be giving several $1 billion of gift cards during this holiday season. And if you want to manage them, upload them to your phone so that you can just carry them, your smartphone with you, and use them that way. Buy and send them electronically. Do some last-minute shopping for gift cards. Go to gift.com, and that's GYFT.com, gift.com, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, Kevin, I hope you have a very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year. We'll talk to you again in 2014. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Marika Saval for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.